Some years ago, the commander of American forces in the former Yugoslavia, General Wesley Clark, said, "There is no room in Europe for an ethnically pure state." Now, normally, if an American makes a statement like, "There is no room in Europe for something," Europeans object, even if Americans hint such a thing. But here was an American giving orders to Europe, and not a whisper of objection was heard. That is because Europe is bravely speaking out against anything that the left calls imperialism, but it is a colony of the United States insofar as some very important issues are concerned, one of which is the melting pot. Every country in Europe has had to accept the idea that it will be diverse, even if the United States Army has to enforce that diversity. That is what Wesley Clark was saying. As a military commander of American forces on European soil, he was saying, there is no room in Europe for an ethnically pure state. Now, every European always thought there was plenty of room for a bunch of countries in Europe, like the communist states, all of which had deadlines. All of them together had a 1,000-mile deadline that I looked at. One part of that deadline was the Berlin Wall. If anybody tried to escape from any communist country, they were shot down in cold blood. There was plenty of room for that. Everybody recognized the communist states. The United States believed in a balance of power between the United States and these slave empires. And if the United States had said, there's no room in Europe for a communist state, Europe would have gone berserk. And of course, they did go berserk when Ronald Reagan referred to the communist empire, which is the term we use now, the Soviet Empire. When he referred to it as the Soviet Empire, Europe went berserk. When Ronald Reagan said that the idea of a country that shot people who tried to escape from it constituted an evil empire, Soviet Empire was evil, Europe went berserk. You can imagine what would have happened if an American commander on European soil had said there's no place in Europe for a communist state. If they went berserk at Ronald Reagan's words, they would have gone nuts over that. But when Wesley Clark said there's no place for an ethnically pure state in Europe, Europe bowed gently and did not say a word. So the European spokesman, the leadership, certainly does not object to American imperialism or Americans telling them what to do, as long as it's leftist thing. What Wesley Clark was saying is actually world policy. What we call the United Nations was set up for the specific purpose of ridding the world of nations, not just political units, but nations. There has not been a nation that has been accepted as a new member of the United Nations since 1950. Let's see, there have been probably 150 countries admitted to the United Nations in the period since 1950. Not one of the political units that came into the United Nations was in fact a nation. We all know that Iraq, for example, consists of a majority of Shiite Muslims, a minority of Sunni Muslims. There is a nation called Armenia, which is split between Turkey and Iran and Iraq, a piece of which is in Iraq, and the Armenians have their own language and thousands of years of tradition. They are a nation. They are not represented in the United Nations. In fact, any time that they mention the possibility that they might unite, the United Nations is against them. We all know that there are nations, for example, in Black Africa. The Shona Nation several million people who speak the same language and have a common background are in Zimbabwe. They are the majority there. They, as soon as white rule ended in Rhodesia, they slaughtered the Bili, who were the minority there, in Rhodesia. But the Bili nation was split. Part of the population is in Zimbabwe, which used to be southern Rhodesia, and a part of the Bili nation is in Zambia, which was a British colonial unit called Northern Rhodesia. The old colonial units of the British Empire, that the British Empire set up, have not been challenged. Like Iraq, these colonies, which were nothing but a conglomeration, hacked off bits of actual nations, been simply admitted to the United Nations, and this makes the title United Nations a rather odd one. The United Nations was set up for the purpose of ridding the world of political units. It is anti-nationalist, but the word nationalist, they don't even know the meaning of the word, because there are precious few nations in the United Nations, and the nations there are dedicated to destroying their nationhood. Now, this may seem like a really great discovery when one finds that something called the United Nations was set up for the specific purpose of doing away with nations and contains practically no nations. But to an old politico like me, it's not only not surprising, I sort of get tired of people running up to me and saying, well, it turns out that all these people who talk about mercy and love are actually for hate and ruthlessness. These people who talk about being the National Education Association are the worst enemies that education has. Well, let me tell you a little secret. That is not a surprise. That is routine. All organizations that want to do away with freedom will be talking an awful lot about freedom. Nobody talked as much about freedom as the communists did. They talked about democracy. Freedom and democracy. Lenin promised peace, land, and bread. Thereupon, he began a 3-year bloody civil war and the Red Terror, which never really ended. There was no peace in Russia. Russia was at war with its own people throughout the communist regime. Millions, tens of millions of Russians were killed in this war. During World War II, Stalin actually said to Roosevelt that his war against the Ukrainian kulaks, meaning really the whole Ukraine, was more difficult than the war against Germany. Stalin had no doubt that he was at war in the 1930s with his own people. The estimates of deaths in the Ukraine run from a minimum of 5 million up to 22 million. Nobody particularly cares in France until Solzhenitsyn's book, The Gulag Archipelago, came out. French intellectuals, French, quote, intellectuals, unquote, and all the others in Europe, all the university professors in Europe, I mean, pretty solidly communist, the universities, and certainly socialist. So they denied the Stalinist holocausts in the plural. And of course, not only was that not illegal, that was considered progressive thinking. Today there are very, very few people who would deny that the Soviet Empire was an empire or that it was evil. This is just common sense. And you will notice pretty well everything I say is a revelation simply because it is bare common sense. David Duke has exactly the same problem I do. He is an experienced person in politics. Like me, he knows this rule. And when people pick up a copy of Jewish supremacism, they always expect to find something like the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. They expect to find an expose of evil geniuses who sit in a little room and give orders to all the Jews in the world, and the Jews are all in on it. But what they read when they actually open the book is common sense. It's sometimes a bit of a disappointment when you expect a wild-eyed expose, and it turns out that the guy that's talking is just talking about things that you can look up in the newspaper. He's just putting them together. Jewish supremacism is banned because, first of all, because it's dangerous to the powers that be, but also they are able to ban it because they compare it to these old conspiratorial books and all of these exposés and all of this nonsense, which is a big burden that both David and I carry around. Jewish supremacism is common sense. It portrays Jews as people whose leadership is dedicated to what it thinks represents Jewish interests. And they have been allowed to go nuts with Jewish interests and a deep-seated hatred of white Gentiles, which you can see all the time. We all know that history always talks about Jews as being unfairly persecuted by white Gentiles. This does not make a people particularly friendly towards white Gentiles. So, what happens is exactly what you would think would happen if you had any common sense, and that's what David is talking about in Jewish supremacism. The communists were shooting people who tried to escape from their national prisons, and for an old politico like me, it is perfectly natural that they're the ones who would talk about freedom, equality, brotherhood, and peace. So, it is routine for a group that calls itself the National Education Association to be a sworn enemy of actual education. That's routine. It is routine that an organization called the United Nations would be the sworn enemy of nationhood. The language that the United Nations uses, besides its own title, is the language that an organization dedicated to the destruction of nationhood would naturally use. The title United Nations was given to an organization that was set up to create one single united world with one single nation and a single culture called political correctness. The language that the United Nations uses illustrates my point. Diversity is the motto by which the United Nations and all of the European leaders seek to destroy the nations of Europe. We all know that. The object of diversity is to make every white country on earth into one uniformly brown-skinned copy of every other white nation on earth. And let me repeat, diversity is bringing in huge numbers of non-whites from the third world into every white country and only into white countries. This is called diversity, and its ultimate aim is to create a uniform brown world where there were white nations. That's its declared aim. Culturally, each one of these diversity units will have a multiculture, a single multiculture. It is very specifically laid out in detail. Every university teaches the doctrine of political correctness and the single multiculture that all the world will have. One single, quote, multiculture, unquote, and each country will be indistinguishable from the other. That is not some sort of plot. That is no secret. That is declared policy. So in order to rid the world of nations, a group has been named the United Nations, and it has declared a policy of diversity, which is aimed at ending all diversity in the white world, making it an extension of the third world. And while the only race that world policy seeks to destroy is the white race, the cultural differences between countries is the target of what we call diversity. Once again, everybody knows this. The policy of destroying nationhood goes by a number of names. It's called burying our differences. It's called a united mankind. It's called all sorts of nice things, but its aim is to destroy the cultural and racial differences that constitute and have always constituted nations. A nation is not a political unit. It has often been said that Poland was split or partitioned a number of times between Germany and Russia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire and anybody else who wanted a peace. But there was no doubt in all that time that no matter what political unit it belonged to, Poland was a nation. Ireland was a nation. While it was an integral part of Great Britain, and of England before that, for centuries, no one ever doubted that Ireland was a nation. So a nation is not a political unit. What calls itself the United Nations is a group of political units. It has positively nothing to do with nations, and in fact, it is an enemy of nations. The United Nations admitted the Soviet Union to membership. The Soviet Union inherited the same country, the same territory that was held by the Tsars, and throughout history, that Russian Empire was called a prison of nations, quote unquote. That was the normal historical term for it. By that they meant that the nations, the Ukraine, the Georgia, all of these other groups, and Karelia, which is Finnish, part of the Finnish nation, all of these groups, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, were imprisoned inside the Tsar's empire. But when they became imprisoned inside the Soviet empire, the Soviet Union suddenly was declared a nation. The prison of nations, when the United Nations began, the prison of nations became a nation in the sense that the United Nations recognizes the word nation. United Nations was as much an enemy of nationality as the Soviet Union was, and as the Tsar was. So the terminology that is used to destroy nations declares itself in favor of diversity, which is what it's seeking to destroy. The name of the organization that seeks to destroy nations is naturally the United Nations. But this is not unusual. The Soviet Empire was based, as I say, on peace, land, and bread, and those were the last three things in the world they offered anybody. And communism is simply the bastard child of a perverted form of Christianity, which enslaved people in the name of freedom, massacred people in the name of mercy, starved people in the name of kindness and generosity. The only thing that makes me tired is that people consider this somehow contradictory. This is not contradictory. This is routine. I would like to see a United Nations. We could We could form a United Nations on the Internet. It would be a set of representatives of nations which insisted on a world of nations. It would insist on Africa being split into what are called, and it's the most insulting word in the world, really, tribes. Now, how do you think the Irish-American community, or Ireland, would react if some professor said, in 1900, Great Britain was a nation and the Irish were a tribe inside of Great Britain? If Africans were white, Europeans would call them nations. They certainly are kind enough to call the Armenians a nation, even though Europe is united against the unification of the Armenian nation. They at least don't call it a tribe. This is a pretty heavy insult, but since black, quote, leaders, unquote, are exactly like European leaders, and they slavishly subscribe to liberal doctrines and political correctness, they never object to the real African nations being called tribes, which goes along with the word savage, as we all know, the word primitive. They really should be upset about this, but their loyalty has nothing to do with black people. That is to say, the black, quote, leaders, unquote, have no loyalty to blacks or any aspect of black life. They certainly don't object to real African nations being called tribes. And, of course, in the United States, the reason I keep talking about Europe is because in the United States, the same rule exactly applies. It's just a somewhat different terminology. The United States, from the beginning, began to get rid of the states. Now, a state is a province, a subunit. Every state capital has a federal flag on top, not a state flag. That was not the way they were originally set up. The states were uniting. They were forming a union. But they themselves remain sovereign units. Well, we all know what happened to that. So the United States has been the worst enemy that states have had. If Europe has slavishly accepted the melting pot and diversity, we invented it. That is to say, the people who beat my people in the Civil War invented that concept. And of course, it really began being pushed when we received a large number of Jewish immigrants here. Emma Lazarus is a wonderful example of this. The Statue of Liberty is always quoted as proving that America is a nation of immigrants. Of course, Emma Lazarus, who wrote that inscription on the Statue of Liberty that everybody keeps quoting, was in favor of two things. She wanted the United States to be open to the whole world, and it was Israel Songwill, who invented the term melting pot, but Emma Lazarus was very much in favor of it for white Gentiles. She was also a dedicated Zionist. The Encyclopedia Britannica in the 1880s referred to Emma Lazarus as, quote, a champion of her race, unquote, her race being the Jews. This is the ultimate anti-racist. This is the person who wrote the inscription on the Statue of Liberty that people are always quoting, give me your tired, your worn, and so forth. But the nation, she wanted herself to be part of a nation made up entirely of Jews, aimed at preserving the Jewish nation. Now, some time back, the Prime Minister of Israel said, Adolf Hitler killed 6 million of my nation. He was not referring to people who were in the political unit called Israel. He was talking about Jews in Europe. They were specifically not in Israel. Hitler never occupied Israel, the area that is now Israel. And, of course, Israel didn't exist during Hitler's lifetime. He knows exactly what a nation is, and like Emma Lazarus, the leaders of Israel believe that there should be only one nation on the planet Earth, and that should be the Jewish nation. And that is why he referred to the fact that Hitler killed 6 million of his nation. He was not referring to a political unit, but nobody had any problem understanding exactly what he was saying, and no one objected to what he was saying. But if I say, when someone kills white people, white Gentiles, they kill members of my nation, I am a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews, I'm a bigot, I'm an awful, awful man, and everybody unites against me. We know that. We've known that all our lives. Once again, I'm not talking about any conspiracy. It's certainly evil. I'm talking about a simple, obvious, well-known fact. One of the most ironic things that I have ever heard of occurred at a Communist International meeting before the Communists took power in Russia. Lenin was the chairman of the international meeting of the Communists. And the Jewish leaders came to him and said that the Jews wanted to speak with one voice. They wanted to be represented as a separate group, and Lenin refused. The Jews were appalled. They wanted a communist international, but they were absolutely astonished that Lenin would not recognize the Jews as the exception. They began to discover that communism was a world religion, and it did not tolerate differences of nationality, including differences of culture, certainly not differences of religion. But they didn't know that it applied to them. Karl Marx ran into this, and he wrote a book called A World Without Jews, which has always been declared to be an anti-Semitic diatribe. I think that Karl Marx would be about the last person you could actually accuse of being anti-Semitic. But when he applied this same idea of a worldwide communist melting pot to Jews that he applied to Christians, that he applied to nationalities all over the world, he was denounced as anti-Semitic. Jews have always had this problem. They were very, very pro-communist, very much for the melting pot. They were the leaders in pushing for the melting pot. They were the leaders in pushing for diversity. And at the same time, they're openly worried to death about the disappearance of Jews or the threat to the Jewish identity. My 1976 book, A Plague on Both Your Houses, began with one of my favorite quotes. It's from Charles Assawi, and this is what it says. Like the generals who are trained to fight the last war, social scientists are fully equipped to recognize and deal with those problems that are already being solved and have given place to different and often opposite problems. Depression in a time when inflation is rife, individual freedom during a period of anarchy, and minority rights when the majority feels unable to protect its interests or assert its will. That's in a book called The Laws of Social Motion by Professor Charles Assawi. And today, that is exactly the situation. The white race is the one that is threatened. So all the social scientists are talking about saving the non-white races, and of course saving the Jews. But the problem today is that the majority in white countries feels unable to protect its interests or assert its will. Well, you couldn't put things any better than that. But what I just read comes from a 1975 book, and it was quoted in my 1976 book. The fact is that besides all the other forces going, what we have is social scientists and those who depend on social scientists for their opinions, worrying about problems that are yesterday's problems. I remember when I was about 12, sitting in the study hall and wondering if the Korean War was ever going to end. I was about 12. The Korean War had gone on for 3 long, long years, a very large part of my conscious life, and there was no end in sight. And I lived through the whole Vietnam War, when all anybody talked about was Vietnam and how that would determine the future, the past, and the present, and everything else. And, of course, I was around for the Iraq War, number 1, the Iraq War, number 2, and what you might call the extension of the second Iraq War, but really it's sort of the third Iraq War that we're going through right now. And this is as much of an unending problem, an immediate problem, a total problem today, as the Korean War was to me when I was in grammar school. But to me, by my age, and having the memory that I have, it's just one more stage of history. The long-term stage of history is being determined by things that are utterly ignored. And one of these things is this whole question of nationhood and survival of groups. Now, the social sciences are very slow. That is to say, Professor Gubelberger comes up with a theory based on the ideas of his day. The concepts that we live by today went from some Professor Gugelheimer to his classes and then slowly filtered down until they are general opinion today, and they are based on the thinking of the 1950s. I can clearly remember the absolutely unchallengeable ideas of the 1950s when I started college, and one of these ideas was that only man has borders. No other animal has frontiers or the sort of silliness, as the social scientists put it, of dividing up territory or dividing themselves into what they call artificial groups. Now, this was seriously believed, and that is very important to us today. Concepts that have filtered down to us by now through the social sciences were formulated on the idea that only man had a territorial instinct and that man would get over this absurd set of divisions he had invented. Now, of course, we find that every animal above the level of a worm is territorial, and man is just one more. We have our border guards, a bird peeps loudly so that the other birds will know that's his territory. We know about chimpanzees patrolling their territories, the borders, in silence, and they will literally tear another chimpanzee to pieces if he doesn't come from their nation, their group. We know all that today. We take that for granted. But the ideologies we're working with are still the tired old ideas that the United Nations was formed on, that the melting pot was formed on, the totally ridiculous, out-of-date idea that animals are naturally kind, that a chimpanzee to another chimpanzee is just a chimpanzee. He's part of the chimpanzee race, just as we're supposed to be part of the human race. That is absolutely untrue, and it is absolutely unnatural. The idea of universalism is totally unnatural. We need to be separated into nations, the way that the, quote, Christians, unquote, and I consider myself a Christian, I'm talking about the, quote, Christians, unquote, the way they deal with that is to say, well, the family is the natural unit, and all these other units are unnatural units. That ended in the human race probably 50,000 years ago, if it was ever true. Family has to be part of a larger unit, just as a person needs to be a member of the family. the family needs to be part of a group, and as your brain becomes more complex, your group needs to be part of another group. But as I say, the social sciences are still dickering around with things that have, as they say, filtered down. And what people forget is it takes a long time for things, for ideas to become fixed, to become filtered down. And so the ideas that the average liberal or conservative has today are from things he absorbed in his youth from somebody who had developed a theory another generation before that. So what we're living on in the long run, and what we're really living on is the long run, what we're living on is totally out-of-date concepts, ridiculously out-of-date concepts. In fact, if most of the concepts that we consider progressive thought today were stated in plain English, they'd be laughable. So they're not stated in plain English. And that is why universalism is so ridiculous, and at the same time, so widely accepted. It's filtered down. So one worldism, diversity, these things are based on concepts that are ridiculously out of date. So what is this concept now called? This concept of one worldism and the melting pot that is based on ridiculously out-of-date science from the 1950s. Well, if you've listened to what I said, I think you could guess what it's called. Remember that the United Nations is the enemy of nations, that diversity is the enemy of diversity, the National Education Association is the enemy of education. So what would an ideology based on the fossil records of intellectual thought of the 1950s, what would this be called? It's called modern opinion. It's called progressive thought. What else could it possibly be called but modern opinion and progressive thought? It's hopelessly out of date. So when the universalists set up their universalist ideas, they immediately split up, as human beings will, into nations of their own. The Maoist communists developed, the Albanian communists developed, the Yugoslavian communists developed, and the Soviet communists developed. And if the whole world were communist, it would be split into at least as many groups as a nationalist world is. That's the way the human being operates. It's ridiculous to talk about one world. Nationalism is natural. And as soon as a universalism takes over, it breaks down into different forms of nationalism. And the whole outdated premise that it was based on is called progressive thought and modern thought. Let me repeat, this is not some great discovery. This is routine.